the first degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
And that identity of like, I'm, you know, from this hard life, but I've made good.
Yeah.
You know, and that identity can be really something people will attach themselves to. So that when things are not good, it's unacceptable.
Yeah.
And so you have to overcompensate by buying into a life that you can't afford. With the money thing that they just overextended themselves in the house or whatever they were buying, you know, and trying to maintain this appearance of Hollywood success moved to Indiana, you know.
Right.
That I feel like that went out of control. And
yeah.
Then the drinking got worse and worse. And, you know, he just took that out on her.
Hey guys, welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Vanek. I'm sitting across from Alexis Linkletter, who is standing next to Billy Johnson, who is sitting. And we're not going to go into a crazy intro today because we have an amazing guest in studio. Margaret Cho is with us, and we're going to get right to it after we talk about today's day.
Happy Answer the Phone Like Buddy the Elf Day.
Which I don't understand.
Yes. Or it's also Big Cookies Day, which is understandable given the holidays, but it's also National Wear a Plunger on Your Head Day.
I like that day.
Yeah.
What's your day, Alexis?
Cookies.
Mm, you don't want to wear a plunger on your head?
Nope.
Oh, interesting.
Mm, oh, all right.
Okay. Well, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
And turn up your anxiety.
Because this could be you.
There are so many species of unrequited love. There's the relationship that ended, one person pining over another, the love triangle that doesn't fall in your favor, blatant rejection, and of course, mind games. What's comforting is that unanswered love is truly the great equalizer. Everybody experiences it in some shape or form at some point. But what if you learned that the subject of your desire married someone else? And then you learned that they murdered their partner in cold blood.
Today's case takes us back to May of 2007. Avril Lavigne's girlfriend and Maroon 5's Make Me Wonder were at the top of the Billboard charts, and movies in the theaters were Waitress and Spider-Man 3.
There are two settings for today's case. The first is Los Angeles, which is where the story starts. When a 20-something girl moves to LA to pursue the dream. And she was of that very small percentage, incredibly small percentage, to actually make it, despite the odds. And that girl was Margaret Cho.
I was doing stand-up comedy, and I had been doing stand-up comedy for kind of a long time in San Francisco, and then touring around. In the dawn of the 90s, I was starting to get more opportunities to do shows in Los Angeles and doing more television. And so I was coming here, and then I decided to move here probably like 1990, 91, some at the latest 91. But it was always kind of like coming back and forth and getting like staying in somebody's house or like staying in an apartment. There was an apartment that I lived in actually close to here with 31 other comedians in the building. And it was an apartment building that had like all single units. So it was almost like SRO, single room occupancy.
Yeah.
But it was sort of spruced up a little bit. And it was all comedians.
Oh my gosh. Fun.
Yeah. It was funny. The rent was $300.
Oh, I wish.
Yeah. At that time, it seemed like a lot of money, actually. But it wasn't at all. And so I lived there. All over Hollywood.
Margaret's career took off and eventually led her to star in a show called All American Girl.
That show was developed around me. So I got a deal in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival, which is a big comedy festival that happens in the summer. And I got this big deal with Disney and Sand Dollar, oddly Dolly Parton and Sandy Gallen, they were in conjunction with them. Dolly Parton sent me a huge box of her makeup.
Oh my gosh.
Really excited.
Lucky.
Love Dolly Parton.
I know.
Love Dolly
Parton.
So this was in 1993. The show actually premiered in 1984.
According to IMDb, All American Girl is ascribed as... This series looked at the culture clashes that occurred between a traditional Korean mother and her fully Americanized daughter. Mom just wants Margaret to marry a respectable man. Doctors, lawyers, scientists, always Korean, while her daughter is more interested in white bikers, musicians, and any other type that her mother is bound to hate. Through all of this, Dad knows better than to interfere and just keeps out of the fray.
And one of the producers working on the show caught Margaret's attention, and his name was John James J.J. Paulson.
I met J.J. Paulson in... he had come along with the writers of my television show. I actually didn't meet him until after he was hired. I didn't have the agency then as the star of the show to actually hire my own writing writer's room. I had to like kind of go along with what the showrunner at the time had sort of wanted. So he made the room, and JJ was the story editor. So we met, actually, I didn't even know who he was until he had presented, I think the episode was like 4 or 5. He had written one of the episodes. And so I think that's when I sort of became like introduced to him.
J.J. Paulson was a TV writer and wrote for shows like In Living Color, Cosby, and Roundhouse, and The Edge in the Carol Burnett Show, All American Girl, and many others. And he'd actually been nominated for an Emmy for his writing, too.
And he was also... in a relationship with somebody named Rachel Sweet, who is a singer and also a comedy writer and television writer now, I believe. And she had worked on her show on Comedy Central, which at that time wasn't Comedy Central. It was Ha.
Oh.
I think called Sweet Time. They were together. But I also knew that he was having an affair with one of the women in the writer's room, who I don't remember her name. But she was one of the writing staff.
And what was your first impression of him?
I didn't really know. I was like, oh, he looks like Gary Oldman, but not in Sid and Nancy, during the press junket for Sid and Nancy.
Well, when he was wearing like loafers, I remember that. I remember a story about him because he played Sid Vicious,
yes.
But he was really kind of like a preppy going into the press junket. I totally know what you're talking about.
Oh my God,
about.
I love that.
So I was like, oh my God, he's so cute. And I hadn't really thought about it, but then I kind of was like, this is a good distraction. I had been dating Garrett Wang from Star Trek. So I had Sulu.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, you're fucking Sulu.
Oh, my God.
It's that's your whole life. That's your whole world.
Hell, oh
yeah.
Yes.
I just think that I wasn't really paying attention because I was, you know, I was with somebody.
Fucking Sulu.
So I was like, you know, and I was also super anorexic because I had like... the major drama around All American Girl was that they were like, you're too fat to play yourself, so you have to lose a bunch of weight. So I had to like be way thinner than I was. And so that was like my focus. So I had somebody I was dating and I had to be thinner. So there was like a lot of things happening in my mind. But I started to notice JJ around the set. And you know, when somebody is having an affair and also in a relationship, they build this kind of sexual like charisma around them that's palpable, that you may not know of the situation of what's going on, but there's something that's happening. There's an energy that seems kind of like active.
So true about other women wanting men.
Yeah.
Because there is something palpable about it, even if you don't know.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
There's an air, because that like man knows.
It's like the big dick energy, but it's like the big cheater energy.
Yeah.
It's kind of lesbian, too. There's like kind of like a, there's a, because I, you know, I do have relationships with women, so there is a kind of like a bonding there. It has something to do with oxytocin being ejected into the air.
It all about the oxytocin.
Yeah. There's a lot of
God
that.
Damn it. And God bless it.
Yeah, literally.
And while Margaret didn't have feelings for J.J. Paulson at first, that started to change.
So I kind of started to pay attention to him, and then I started to like him. And then he was somebody who drank alcohol, and I didn't really drink alcohol. And I was like, this is curious. And we would do these tapings of the show, and we would go to a bar, all the cast and crew. And everybody would drink. And I just thought, oh, how glamorous to be like an adult and in your 30s. And like to me, to be 36, I believe is 36, was just like the oldest person in the world. old, be drinking, and it'd be so cool. And I remember like thinking, okay, how am I going to try to get his attention? Maybe he was selling his car. He had an Acura Vigor. And I was like, oh, I'll buy it because I want it. And I'll do these things like these dumb girl things like, what do I do to get into his? Because we had no like Instagram to stalk. Mm-hmm. We had no sliding into DMs. We had no texting even.
Yeah.
So you would even have to like figure out how to get into their life somehow. And then, you know, like the, for me, it, you know, my status, it was sort of a little bit awkward because it's like, yeah, I guess I am his boss, but I wasn't really conscious of that. It, to me, he felt like he was more my boss in a lot of ways. Like he sort of felt like an authority figure because he was an adult and because he was in the writer's room. And that was just sort of a thing that I wasn't really aware of.
Now, and him being the story editor, he's in charge of the story that you're telling each week.
Yes.
So he's going to come in and he probably was telling... doing not really directing, but like doing like, no, this goes here, this goes there.
Yeah.
So that on top of the age mm-hmm. and on top of whatever charisma that he has, mm-hmm. he's really hitting you in a lot of different spots.
Yes. So it was like, you know, just kind of like thing of also projecting onto an older man what I think older men are like, or what I think a guy's going to be like, or that a man is going to be like, because everybody I'd been with up to that point had been a boy in a lot of ways. You know, they were all boys. They were my age or a little younger or like just boys. So it was not, you know, it was like kind of a crush that was like almost like a crush you get on a teacher
mm-hmm.
Or like professor, maybe a little older, like you're in college. So there's a possibility.
So although Margaret developed a crush on Paulson over the course of their time working together, the relationship never really got off the ground.
I think we went out on a couple of dates that were strange, odd. It really kept me at arm's length, and I couldn't, you know, seem to get in. And then I was like, why does this guy not like me? Like, I was just so used to everybody doing exactly what I wanted them to do, and it was just not in my realm of experience to be rejected, especially from somebody who had agreed to go out with me two times. We never had sex or anything, and we never actually, like, made out or anything. There was nothing like that, but there was an attraction that existed that was something that could have been worked on. I think that he was overwhelmed because he was already in a relationship and cheating on her. And then I added another level of like complexity that he just didn't want, but also didn't say no to.
So even with the confusion of the unrequited love, the show wraps, the curtains close, and life moves on for Margaret.
The show eventually was canceled, of course, and then he moved to go work on Bill Cosby's show outside of the Cosby Show,
which was I think just called Cosby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So he moved to New York. I think I saw him once coming onto the Radford lot because I saw the Acura Vigor that I wanted to buy coming out.
Like, that's my car.
Yeah, I saw him coming out, and I was going in, and it was like he whipped his head around, and I looked, and then he was gone, and then. There was, I think that was the last time.
And we all know that Margaret would go on to have an incredibly successful career, but thoughts of J.J. Paulson loomed over her.
I think, like, what it was really, like, yeah, he just didn't give me any answer. Kind of non-emotional rejection. Mm-hmm. That, would, to me, was, like, really upsetting. Because I feel like you're going to reject somebody, you've got to feel really bad about it. You can't just, like, reject them in a very non-confrontational way.
Well, and that's probably hard. That's even worse than if somebody did something super shitty because you can't be mad at them.
Yeah.
No, so apathy just, like, is more is painful worst. Than cruelty.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, because at Absolutely. Least cruelty, they're trying to... elicit a response.
And there's a sense of love in the hate. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Victorian era. It's an analog ghosting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like a really like early adopter ghosting.
Which he was ahead of his time.
Yeah, really way ahead of his time. And you know, that's like, but that's something that can really drive you crazy because if you just don't hear, you don't know. It's just never.
The limbo.
And it was like a really upsetting one and a really, you never really get over it.
17 years later, Margaret decides to look J.J. Paulson up to see what he ended up doing with his life.
I never really thought about it until many years later. I realized that you could Google people. That was like the mid-2000s when I realized, oh, Google exists and I could find out where he is. And so I looked it up and I saw it was a very short entry on Wikipedia that he was a writer on my show and that he had gotten married and killed his wife.
So remember how we said there were two settings to the story? Here's the second. Carmel, Indiana, which is where J.J. Paulson moved to in 2004 after the wrap of The All-American Girl. Paulson had gotten married to a woman named Leanne, and he met her in 1999 in New York City. They married in Los Angeles on November 20th, 2003. In March of 2004, he and Leanne moved to Carmel, Indiana, and purchased a house. Paulson had planned to write a manuscript. It did not otherwise work while he was in Indiana. I think he was just sort of like moving to Indiana. I'm going to be a writer
serious
in seclusion.
Writer.
You know, I'm going to do this thing. And in time, the Paulsons' finances fell into disarray, and their marriage became very turbulent.
The marriage between J.J. Paulson and Leanne looked like a perfect one, but in actuality, it was riddled with alcohol and abuse. Police had been called twice to their Carmel home after Leanne Paulson said her husband had beaten her in the past.
So let's look into Leanne's history. Leanne Serrano had been Carmel High School's homecoming queen in 1985. And then she went to Indiana University and she graduated. She pursued her dreams of acting and singing up until she met Paulson. And in Indiana, she actually appeared in local theater productions and in a national tour of Jesus Christ Superstar. And she was also in the American Cabaret Theater. And she was a regular cast member in the Yuletide celebration in Indianapolis and the New York City Rockettes Christmas special.
And Leanne was very close with her family, but that changed a few years into her marriage with J.J. Paulson. They started seeing less and less of Leanne, and it seemed as if they had lost contact with her completely by April of 2007. But her sisters really wanted to change that, and they started reaching out to her more frequently, wanting to get their relationship closer and back on track. They tried over and over to reach their sister, but the calls went unanswered. But finally, her sisters did hear back from J.J. Paulson, and he told them that Leanne had been struggling with alcohol addiction and said that she actually was going to rehab. The sisters asked for contact information to the rehab center, and he came up with one excuse after the next as to why he could not provide that to them. In fact, at one point, he actually asked Leanne's sister, Sharon, to lend him her car so that he could take Leanne to the airport to go to this rehab center. But then days later, he called Sharon back to say Leanne had decided not to go to rehab at all, but he still would not facilitate contact between the two sisters. And when Sharon threatened to come to their house to confront her sister about either going to rehab or why she hadn't been back in touch with her, he tried to convince her not to by telling her that Leanne had, in fact, already left for California to go to rehab.
So then Leanne's other sister, Katie, contacted the California Rehabilitation Center to confirm whether it was prepared to receive Leanne. And a representative told her that the facility was not expecting her at all. And this is when Katie confronted J.J. Paulson, who again insisted that Leanne was already en route to Los Angeles. So he's going back and forth all over the place.
Yeah. Something's up. And everyone suspected that Paulson was keeping Leanne from her family. And they weren't surprised because everyone knew that Paulson was abusive. And his behavior is such classic in terms of coercive control. He's isolating his victim from her family. So it's no surprise that it's what they all thought was going on.
And friends noticed too. On April 13th, J.J. Paulson told a visiting friend named Ken that his wife was just upstairs in bed. The next day on April 14th, he called and asked the same friend if Ken could take him and Leanne to the airport 2 days later. But then on the next day, the 15th, he called Ken again and advised him not to come over because he had a personal problem that needed to be taken care of.
But everyone would find out why Leanne was radio silent on April 17th. When Leanne's sister Sharon lost her patience about her inability to reach Leanne. That day, Sharon left messages and emails for J.J. Paulson, demanding to know why she couldn't reach her sister. And she was also letting him know that she planned to stop by and see Leanne later in the day, whether she heard from them or not. And J.J. Paulson called Sharon back in an irritated manner, stated that he was offended by the messages she had left him.
But Sharon was done playing nice. She missed her sister, she was worried about her sister, and she was going to have the police stop by the home to do a welfare check on Leanne. But she didn't tell J.J. Paulson that.
And police arrived at the home for a welfare check the next day at 3:30 p.m. Officer Curtis Scott of the Carmel Police Department arrived at the home, and when he entered, he found the couple's 16-month-old son, Christopher, hungry, dehydrated, and alone inside their house. The house was littered with decaying food, trash, and dog urine and feces throughout the entire place. The officer tried to turn on the lights, and he found that all the utilities inside the home had been shut off.
Then he entered the master bedroom, and he could see that there were signs of a struggle. There was a broken and splintered bed frame, as well as this big gaping hole in the drywall. So they started searching the house for any sign of an adult, like anyone that's going to care for this baby that's there. And they're looking around, and they discover a small closet. And inside the closet has a crawl space, and this is in the master bedroom. And the crawl space leads to an attic. And it was actually blocked by a bunch of storage bins and inline skates and things. But as soon as they got close to it, they could smell that smell. And it was the unmistakable smell of death. So when they entered the door, they found the remains of Leanne. She was naked. She was lying face down. And she was just sort of haphazardly thrown there like trash. And even more horrifying, they could see that her body had been partially mummified. So she had been there a while.
How long had Leanne been dead? How had she been killed? How could he sleep in that bedroom, in that home, with her just lying feet away from him, decomposing? And did he think that she would just go away and no one would miss her and he'd be able to sort of smoke and mirrors distract people indefinitely? And the police immediately start searching for J.J. Paulson, and it didn't take long for them to find him. They found him wandering around an intersection in Carmel 4 hours later. He was wearing two pairs of jeans, two shirts, a sweatshirt, a fleece vest, and an overcoat. He was also carrying a backpack containing a cell phone, a knife, toiletries, vodka, and additional clothing. And J.J. Paulson, when approached by investigators, told them that he actually left his son at home so he could go out and search for his wife. That was the only reason. And he believed that Leanne was out binge drinking on a tear. Then he asked for a lawyer.
They placed J.J. Paulson under arrest for neglect, and Christopher, his son, was put into the custody of Child Protective Services. J.J. then accompanied police to the headquarters where he was read his Miranda rights before he spoke with the CPS caseworker. J.J. Paulson told the caseworker that he had left Christopher alone so he could search for Leanne. Police checked Paulson's criminal history and learned that he had previously been convicted of domestic battery against Leanne and was currently on probation. Those charges stemmed from a 2005 incident where a pregnant Leanne drove to a relative's home wearing bloodstained clothing and said that Paulson had beaten her.
So an autopsy conducted on Leanne would reveal that she'd been dead for at least a week, but possibly as long as 3 weeks. The cause of death was subdural hemorrhage, caused by blunt force trauma to the head from multiple kicks and or punching. Extensive bruising covered Leanne's head, back, arms, and legs. And also, two of her ribs had been broken post-mortem. And that indicated that her body had been moved and or abused after her death. So on May 3rd, 2007, the state charged Paulson with murder.
After J.J. Paulson was arrested and charged with his wife Leanne's murder, the local news caught hold of the story. Then the national news. And then news of the killing made it to J.J. Paulson's Wikipedia page, which is where Margaret learned about what happened.
I was in real shock about it. I was really, really shocked. I mean, he had murdered his wife. He had left her body in their, attic. It had been there for so long that she had partially mummified. It's a horrifying thing. He had left their baby son to just sort of walk a long distance, just abandoned this kid there.
In Margaret's shock and confusion about J.J. Paulson committing a crime like this would increase as she learned the details. J.J. Paulson had spun an elaborate web of lies to Leanne's family members, to friends of theirs, and to acquaintances, insinuating that Leanne was still alive for weeks.
You know, like there was like a way that he could talk to people that was sort of believable, that they didn't go searching for her for this amount of time.
Well, in the early 2000s, also there was a kind of a thing of like where you could probably do that. You could say, well, somebody's, you know, at rehab, they can't talk. So he bought himself like 28 days.
And interestingly, in the months leading up to Leanne's death, the Paulsons were named in a series of lawsuits filed by creditors who won judgments seeking nearly $700,000 in debts. One mortgage claim for nearly $620,000 prompted foreclosure proceedings on their home. And as we know, financial difficulties can cause a lot of problems within a marriage.
And what it sounds like, what it looks like, is from serious alcoholism,
yeah,
and some serious money problems, which I think are, you know, something that I understand. But it goes beyond that with what ended up happening with his wife.
Yeah, when you think about it, as far as, you know, being in debt $700,000 in the 90s in Indiana, based on your mortgage, I mean, that had to have been the biggest house in the town.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's really kind of unreasonable to think about. But it's, I think that need to also appear as if you're doing well probably comes from his own background.
The background that Margaret is referring to is J.J. Paulson's upbringing. And she knows about this because he told her.
His own story about his own upbringing, about how poor they were, how hungry they were, how I think they had like these kids like were fighting over a bag of old radishes and one of them had like mold on it. And they were like fighting over it, you know, like his siblings fighting over this food. And so, you know, you had a sense of him being like really like needing a kind of darkness to survive. Like building up this dark shadow self in order to be able to eat and to live and, you know, continue. So there's something of that to him, that there's a little bit of like artful dodger. There's a kind of Dickensian archetype in there somewhere. Yeah. He's scrappy. And I think that is the character that if I've ever loved a character in like fiction, it would be the artful dodger. Uh-huh. You know, that's like always going to be my boyfriend. He also told me that his brother and his uncle had died, I think, on a Tuesday. He's like, his brother died on a Tuesday and his uncle died on a Thursday on the same week.
Wow.
And so that had a lot to do with kind of this familial misery. It was like a very classic tale of alcoholism, poverty, no social services, maybe too proud to tap into social services. It's just, the hard, difficult circumstances of his life, but then those circumstances kind of like really defining his character and defining a way that he would move about the world, just getting whatever he could. And that identity of like, I'm, you know, from this hard life, but I've made good,
yeah.
You know, and that identity can be really something people attach themselves to, so that when things are not good, it's like unacceptable.
Yeah.
And so you have to overcompensate by buying into a life that you can't afford. With the money thing, that they just overextended themselves in the house or whatever they were buying, you know, and trying to maintain this appearance of Hollywood success moved to Indiana, you know. And
right.
That I feel like that went out of control. And then the drinking got worse and worse. And, you know, he just took that out on her.
And what about the fact that prior to killing his wife, J.J. Paulson seemed to have completely abandoned show business and moved from either New York or LA, where he was working as a TV writer, to Carmel, Indiana?
My hypothesis about it is that he was, I think his drinking just got out of control and he just couldn't write anymore. And I think, you know, as writers, you know that like you can't be that fucked up. You have to have some part of your brain still like functioning to be able to write. Like, especially if you're like writing on a TV show, because the amount you have to produce
it's prodigious. It's like you have to keep on going, and you can't be fucked up. You can't be messed up with that kind of stuff. You can't be hungover in the writer's room, I think. So I think that I think his good faith had bought him a lot of jobs, but then he probably got fired a lot or laid off because he couldn't produce.
And so it turns out that in the 2 years leading up to Leanne's murder, Paulson's abuse of her had escalated greatly. Their son, Christopher, was born in December of 2005. And after he was born, the violence really kicked into high gear. He broke Leanne's nose on one occasion. At this point, it's been confirmed that Leanne started drinking heavily herself, and she was arrested for a DUI. Paulson also drank heavily. And in May of 2006, he was arrested for domestic battery of Leanne and was subsequently placed in a pretrial diversion program. However, he did not successfully complete the diversion program because on October 20th, 2006, he was arrested again for domestic battery of Leanne. There were two domestic violence cases that Leanne Paulson initiated, but she later refused to testify against her husband and endorsed a plea agreement that allowed him to avoid a jail term. And this is all behavior that is very indicative of, like we've talked about, a coercive, control, abusive relationship. And when Margaret was involved with J.J. Paulson, she experienced his manipulation and some of his tactics firsthand in some ways.
I think that it's definitely, my first foray into abusive relationships, which I have had now a couple of them since then. And now I know the signs. He also wouldn't reciprocate my, my feelings. So that was incredibly infuriating and difficult. And you know, when you're young like that, like you just can't believe it. You're going to try and try and try. I couldn't hear no.
And in the months that followed those initial beatings on Leanne and when she decided not to testify against him, things just got worse.
And J.J. Paulson really started to alienate Leanne from her friends and family. He thwarted their efforts to communicate with her, and as a result, Leanne's family had no contact with her after December 30th of 2006. And according to Leanne's family, the isolation seemed to follow, again, like Alexis said, a classic abuse victim pattern, believing that one day her abuser might stop and he'll become the person that she thought that he was when she fell in love with him.
You know, like in the other sort of abusive relationships I've been in, it is like a slow kind of coercive control where you're slowly kind of isolated from your friends and family. And then you only are looking at one person for all of your like beliefs and your ideas and confirmation for that, your reality. So then you start to question your own sanity.
Yeah.
Is there anything in hindsight about his personality, charisma or temper or anger or edge in hindsight that you see that could maybe lead you to believe he was capable of something like this?
Yeah, I think that, well, there was that, all of those things, because there was something kind of like, you know, there was something very charming about him, but he wasn't particularly handsome. He wasn't particularly smart. He wasn't particularly, there was nothing special that is like so over the top exciting, but that real, it's almost like, he just really got his hooks into me, and I don't know how, but he did. And so I'm not sure. I really don't know. But, you know, it was partially my youth, partially my own vulnerability at that time, thinking about, you know, what I wanted out of relationships, what I wanted out of, like, just being on a television show, and what I wanted my adult life to be like, that there was a projections that I had on my own, I think, around alcohol, around a guy who drinks, around a troubled guy who drinks. Those kinds of ideas that I had. I like Charles Bukowski.
I was just going to go there, yeah.
Love Bukowski.
Hunter S. Thompson. I love them all.
I love all those guys, you know? So I thought, well, this is my sort of attempt at something like that, because everybody I knew wasn't as destructive as that. And so, you know, you sort of, it's a process of growing up, and it's that maturity that doesn't allow your heart to make these decisions that aren't even based on a real person. They're based on a projection. Like, I could not have known him well enough to have built all of this connection to him. There's just no way. So it's like the power of our own self-deception and projection and desire that built it, you know, and all of these other women's desires complicating it, and my own problems in my life making it even more dramatic.
so interesting and so true and insightful. You project everything, and it's the idea of somebody rather than it could be anybody, but it just happened to be him.
Yeah, really, it has a lot to do with, you know, your uterus and all of these hormones in your 20s that create this drama. Once you realize that, then life becomes a lot calmer and it feels a lot better. But it's really hard to get to that point. And some people never snap out of it.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also difficult if that person happens to be what I believe he's probably a psychopath. So, and it's like he was using these, like, not like love bombing, but it was all those different kind of textbook things that somebody like that would, which pulls you in more. And that's, it's so hard to escape even afterwards.
Yeah.
And on December 23rd, 2008, he actually pled guilty. But he pled guilty to voluntary manslaughter. And he was sentenced to 26 years. And there was a caveat to his plea. And it should have been covered by Son of Sam laws, but they wanted to make it clear that he cannot write, produce, or direct, or collaborate with anyone in those activities to profit from his wife's death.
We all agree that J.J. Paulson did a horrible, disgusting thing. And we have Margaret here with us to kind of corroborate sort of his personality. And we know by his actions what kind of person he is. But I went on a crazy deep dive on this case, and I found a thread on Web Sleuths. And it was people who knew J.J. who were talking about him. So this is all from Web Sleuths. One user said the following: J.J. is an interesting character. One person who knew him at the start of his career painted a portrait of a workplace psycho, a, quote, snake in a suit, a guy who manipulated others and was only out to gain power over the situation. Then people who wrote me from the West Coast talked about a very laid-back guy, more California than Queens, where JJ was from. Another user said this: an ex of JJ's who dated him several years ago said he was a monster, though. A former roommate of Leanne's, the roommate, he's openly gay, was not her boyfriend, said that after she began seeing JJ, Leanne cut her old friend out of her life completely. No men in her life.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that's three sort of vantage points into JJ. Those are three separate perspectives, none positive. That being said, it's like when something like this happens, people remember the worst thing you did and harp on it. And I'm sure, I mean, if that happened to any of us, it would happen. But I think it's clear and obvious that JJ is a manipulative monster. If you're isolating someone from their family, you're manipulating the situation where people think she's asleep up in bed. I mean, this is a liar. This is a monster. This is a psycho. This is an abuser. Yeah. And he chose Leanne to victimize. Leanne's life was stolen from her abruptly. And Christopher now doesn't have a mother, and Lord only knows how he suffered through all of this. And I think the most important thing we have to remember is Leanne. Leanne, Leanne, Leanne. We're deconstructing J.J. Paulson so we can understand how Leanne's precious life was stolen. And so all of us can hopefully have some more insight into these types of abusers so we can avoid them and protect ourselves from them. Because guess what? J.J. Paulson was released early from prison. He's out. He was released in September of 2016, which means he spent less than 7 years in prison for beating his wife, Leanne, to death and abandoning their 16-month-old baby in their home.
But I know that he's out of prison now. I don't know where he is, but I'm kind of like, that's such a weird feeling for him to be out. I don't think he spent very much time in there for considering what he had done. And I did have some communication with her family, and they were just, you know, they're just heartbroken. They don't want him out. They're really upset that he's out. I know that. I feel really bad for Leanne's family, and you know, I really feel for them. They're kind of stuck in amber. You know, the amount of pain that they feel and can never be resolved, really. Yeah. You know, so that's the hard part about it. You know, in talking about it, like, I always think about their feelings and what they must go through. You know, it's also maybe their love for her gets remembered in a good way.
J.J. Paulson's disgusting murderous act and subsequent early release beg many questions. Had you ever been in love before?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I had had relationships, different kinds of relationships, but I had never like had a love that was like unrequited.
If he like Googled himself and found this podcast, mm-hmm. What would you want him to hear?
Well, I mean, I don't want him in my life, and I don't think that I need to hear his side of the story, and I don't think that this would be a good thing for either of us.
What could a side of the story possibly be? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like,
terrifying.
You beat your wife to death. Yeah. There's no...
You beat your wife to death. It wasn't a one-time thing.
Yeah.
You've done it before.
Well, I certainly feel as if he's done enough bad stuff that, you know, he can now afford to do some good things.
Do you often think that that potentially could have been you?
I don't know. Because he... I think I was just too, like, forceful. There is nothing passive about my personality. If I like somebody, I'm like so aggressive. Something like that would just be, I think, too much of a person. I think I'm too much of a person.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
So learning about what J.J. Paulson had done deeply impacted Margaret. So much so that she channeled this confusion and this reaction into something creative.
And at the time, I had been writing music, and so I wrote the lyrics to a song that seemed to sort of work out my feelings about it, and I gave them to Andrew Bird, who wrote the music for me, and then we ended up singing it together and recording it and making a video and stuff, and it's called I'm Sorry.
And side note, we're going to be playing Margaret's song, I'm Sorry, at the end of our episode, so make sure you stick around so you can hear it.
And it's all these it's a little bit of a murder ballad, but it really is kind of from his perspective in a lot of ways. Or it sort of talks about some of my feelings around it. And I mean, I don't know. Like, I still feel like really strange. Like, after the song came out, I got somebody sent me an email that was really from him, but he was still in prison. And he was telling me that he had heard the song and he wanted to tell me his side of the story, which I don't want.
Oh,
I don't think that there's anything to gain from that.
We never think that we're going to be grateful that we never had the chance to explore the possibilities with someone that we're in love with. But I think this is a great example for the fact that anytime someone rejects you, strings you along, lies to you, manipulates you, or hurts you, you should consider it a dodge bullet.
Your house on fire. I am a victim of my own desire, and I'm sorry I sent you that suicide letter. I was gonna die, but then I felt better, and I'm sorry I shot you in the face. I got this feeling I was way off base. Dramatic, and I know your family is so bereaved, but I just couldn't let you leave. And yes, I made a big mistake, but my love for you was not fake, and I just had all I could take, so I drowned you in the lake. And now they're calling for an autopsy. I just wanted you to notice me. You just wouldn't love me, and this I can't forgive. My pride was stronger than your will to live.
Well, big thanks to Margaret Cho for being with us today. She's going to stick around for Killing Time. But until then, if you guys have a story to tell, please email us hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram @thefirstdegree, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackVanek. Join our Facebook group. Just search The First Degree in the search bar.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers. Keep your friends close.
But not that close. Sources for today's episode include The Indie Channel, IMDb, Web Sleuths, IndieStar, WTHR 13, Court Documents, and as always, our First Degree interview is always our largest source.
All right, welcome to a very, very special episode of Killing Time. We have Margaret with us, and we're going to just jump right in.
We're going to jump right in. I was at Margaret's house a couple of weeks ago. I was on your podcast, The Margaret Show, which is one of the best names ever, and I only got it after maybe four times of seeing it.
Oh, wow, I just got it.
Yeah.
Wait, I just still don't get it. The Margaret Show?
Well, it's like the show.
Oh, the show. Yeah.
It's like the very basic pun. There's not really, there's no warning that it's going to be a pun.
Yes.
No, it's good.
Yes.
So, yes.
It's really
and it's
good.
Obvious once you get
once
it.
Yeah. Once you get it, it's obvious.
Yeah. Yes. For us slow people, it just takes a second.
It's early for me.
And we also have a special guest, too.
This is Lucia. Lucia is my chihuahua, and she is, she's kind of offended by podcasting, which is really weird. I don't know if she thinks it's the wrong, like, the too far for media to be going. It's too intimate. I don't know. Like, she just has some issues. She's kind of a Luddite. She doesn't have a smartphone.
Right. I think she needs to write like a tell-all once, you know, once she learns enough.
Definitely.
She must have seen.
There's like some kind of a Mommy Dearest in the making coming up. Coming out.
And this is our first ever dog appearance, too.
This is our first.
Yeah.
We've been asking for dogs.
We've been asking for dogs forever. Yeah. And we want the dogs.
It feels good to have a dog around. But sometimes they don't, I mean, just like her, she's not that fond of technology. So it's, you know, she has a lot of opinions.
She's so chill for a chihuahua.
She is. She's pretty chill for a chihuahua.
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 So I have a question.
Kay.
So we obviously just did your story, and that is your obviously first degree connection.
Yes.
Do you like true crime?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I'm a fan of the Murder Squad.
Yeah.
And I'm a very old school fan of a Murderino, my favorite murder. Karen Kilgariff and I are old friends, and you know, she would come over to my house in the 90s, and there was a bookstore called Amok on Vermont, which had a lot of really crazy conspiracy theory books, but also a lot of true crime stuff.
Mm.
And so we would go there and we would get like a lot of these books and talk about it. There was, you know, just a lot of, I remember in the 90s, there was, I think we had sort of rediscovered culturally the Black Dahlia. And that was when Steve Hodell had sort of come out with his book.
Black Dahlia Avenger.
Yes.
Yeah.
And started talking about George Hodell and the family. And so, you know, it was like this introduction into culture that true crime had always had a place in mainstream culture, but it was a little bit like for old ladies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or like Miss Marple or Agatha Christie. And then, I mean, of course, that's a fictional mystery, but there was a sort of a morbid curiosity that older ladies seem to possess that the rest of the culture didn't. So, but I've always been into it. I've always been a little old lady at heart.
Yeah. Well, I think
so.
I think
true. My grandma was so into it.
I know. And now it's little. now it's all us millennials.
Yeah.
And it's weird too. I think a lot of people did. You know, when I go back and I look at the what true crime was. Before it was on television, when it was these magazines, and you could, they were directed towards men. They had sexy women on the cover in peril. Mm-hmm. All the ads were like, be taller or learn how to plumb and all this other stuff. Yeah. It was all about that. And, or like the Charles Atlas ads or something. They weren't directed towards women. And, you know, this switch happened at some point in our culture. And then it got amplified after Serial and then with Karen and Georgia. And then it just, everything just exploded. And the, and I met Karen and Georgia for the first time at one of your shows, right after one of your shows.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at Upright Citizens Brigade. Yeah.
So amazing. Oh my God. So amazing.
I didn't know that you knew Karen so long. That's crazy.
Yes. Karen and I were friends in our late teens. We both started comedy around the same time. She was a little bit younger than me. And Janine Garofalo convinced us to move to Los Angeles like in 1990 or something.
Holy shit. That.
And we came here and, you know, it was definitely a different world. And it was just so, it was so fun. And she's remained the same person throughout all of this, you know, throughout all this time and throughout all this success. And it's very exciting, you know, to see all the stuff that she's doing, you know, but I'm always like kind of missing her because I never see her because she's so busy. We're both so busy. So it's great to listen to My Favorite Murder because it's like I know all the stories, the backstories that she'll punch in sometimes with Georgia. And then I'm like, oh my God, that's me. Mm-hmm. Or it's a friend of ours. And
that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were just on, it's a bucket list for a lot of people. You played a villain on Law and Order.
Really? Seriously? Serious bucket list. It was a woman who was actually, she was a real person. And she had trafficked a lot of people from China, from around the Yellow Sea. So it's like the Fujian province or something like that, where they have a lot of these workers come over and then they were in indentured servitude to her for many years to pay for their passage. And some people thought of her as, you know, of course, a human trafficker, which she was. But then also other people sort of looked at her in this very heroic light, which is strange. But she did help people kind of earn their freedom in a way. And so I played her on Law & Order SVU. It was so exciting. She actually died in prison, the real person. But hopefully my character, I think, survived. So maybe we'll see my character again.
And who got to interrogate you?
Olivia Benson, Mariska Hargitay, which is great. And I love her. And I know her actually also from the 90s. All of us old like actresses, we all know each other, which is great.
That is
so
cool,
it's fun.
Though.
She's awesome.
She's awesome.
That's a total bucket list.
She's like one of my favorite TV actresses.
Incredible.
She's
and that show is incredible. And it's been on for 21 years. It's the longest running show since Gunsmoke.
I was binging it yesterday. I was binging it yesterday. And it's like, they're all exciting. They're all good. Yeah. And it's never stale. And it's not like Grey's Anatomy, for example. I don't know how many seasons they're in. It's like I turn it on and I'm like, ugh, they're not self-contained. You can just jump right back into Law and Order and love Olivia. You're so invested in her.
Yeah. And then also the love work that she does too with and the backlog and everything like that. No, she's awesome.
She really does live that life too. Yeah. You know, it's like she backs up her character with a lot of amazing work, you know, public social work, all that stuff. Yeah. So she's great.
I love that.
Yeah.
I have a question. Is there a certain case or situation, true crime, that got you into it? Or have you always been a fan? Or is there something that you always come back to?
There's a couple. The ones that are maybe more modern that sort of got me more into like listening to podcasts would be Bear Brooks. Mm-hmm. This one that Billy and I talked about, which, you know, he had a lot to do with the story getting out. And so that one was really caught my attention. People's Temple, which I grew up around in San Francisco, probably maybe was more of an entry point because it happened in 1978. My parents actually rented out the People's Temple Hall because it had been recently vacated by the People's Temple when they went to Guyana.
When they went to Guyana,
so they had rented it for my grandparents' wedding anniversary, 50th wedding anniversary.
Oh my gosh.
So it was almost like that was a sort of predetermined thing, that this was something that my family was really talking about a lot, along with the Harvey Milk, George Moscone assassination, because that happened the same month.
Yeah, there was the same month.
Holy cow.
Yeah,
oh my God,
San Francisco had, it was just, I mean, think about it. It was, you know, a huge community leader and the mayor are killed right after this horrific incident happened in Guyana.
So it was and we had
Jonestown episode, a couple episodes.
Yeah. We had three survivors on our show.
Jim Jones Jr.
Jim Jones Jr.
Incredible. That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And there's a huge funeral plot, I believe, in Oakland, where there's about the 800 people that are interred there, which is, it's really, I mean, the enormity of that disaster was just, it's mind-boggling.
Yeah, somebody, I think it was in our Facebook group, was talking about how the people who had to clean up the
bodies,
site were just traumatized. Total PTSD, and that's something that nobody talks about, because, I mean, you've seen the area, I've seen aerial footage of that.
Oh, and it's incomprehensible.
So imagine being on the ground, trying babies and things. It's just unbelievable that that happened.
Well, and that's like kind of the reason why we started our podcast too, because you don't understand the ripple effects from something that's happening with that, where it's that affected thousands and thousands of people that nobody talks about.
And another thing nobody talks about was getting remains home. To burials.
Yeah,
and
to Oakland and things.
They were just sitting in warehouses and they were exploiting people trying to get their loved ones home, and it's just things that you don't even consider when you think about Jonestown.
Yeah.
But so much of the story is, you know, people have this thing of like, how could they drink the Kool-Aid, which it was not even Kool-Aid,
but flavoring. But the biggest misconception.
Like, you know, I look back at the whole story and I look at the church, the temple itself, in the very beginnings. Of course I would have joined. Of course I would have gone, because it was about racial equality. Yep. It was about let's all come to God with our real modern problems. Like, if you look at somebody like Joel Osteen, it's not that far removed. You know, I mean, it's just a very easy thing. Like, I could totally see, like, or when a few years ago when people were really into The Secret.
Oh my God. Yeah. I loved it.
I love The Secret.
Loved it.
But that's the same kind of mentality that drew people to Jim Jones, that there was a goodness in his heart in the beginning.
Yeah.
That people got, and they're like, well, yeah, let's just, you know, this country is racist. Let's leave. Let's all go to this new place where we can forge a new land. And there was sort of this idealism that I could really understand.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Nobody joins a cult.
Yeah, nobody joins a cult.
They
cult
start
knowingly.
Hanging out with friends and they feel good. And they're like, I like these people. Uh-huh. It's not, you don't join a cult. You just do things that that align. You hang out with people who have ideals that align with yours.
Absolutely.
And then suddenly the powerful leader just sort of becomes a megalomaniac.
Yeah.
What's the slowness of it? Mm-hmm. Like, and it's like, you know, it's like an abusive relationship.
I was literally just thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, you know, the little like things of isolating you, and then, you know, bringing like the love bomb and all that. It's like all those things happening, not to just one person, but many, many people.
Yeah. It's a scary thing.
Yeah.
Billy?
I think we're good.
Yeah.
We've killed some time.
We killed 11 minutes and 11 seconds of time.
Felt it.
You were good.
You're always good.
You felt it.
Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it so much. You're so amazing. So
we're
so excited.
I'm so excited.
Thanks, Margaret. Right. Thanks, Lucia.
That showbiz, baby.
That showbiz, baby.
Cool.
Cool. Yeah.